Part 2. Frank meets his first master. About 3 months ago, I met in my sleep a great man. I spoke about it to the Telugu Munshi here. The Munshi brought me some pictures. I picked out the man at once from the others. Last Friday, this man was coming through Vellore to go to a theosophical conference at Tiruvannamalai. He does not belong to the Theosophical Society. All masters work for the common good. When the train came in, I recognized him at once. He is about 5 feet 10 inches in height and well built, with a high round forehead and aquiline nose. Good looking in every sense of the term. He got out of the train and we sat together in the waiting room. It is impossible to describe what it is like to be in the presence of a master. I did not know he was a master, but to sit in his presence, though he hardly said a word and does not know English, was to feel oneself thrilling through and through, to feel new impressions touching one mentally. It was an extraordinary experience. I learned later that he was the first Sanskrit scholar in India, and that is saying something out here, where Sanskrit is the language of the scriptures and every student of wisdom learns it. He knows the sciences inside out and many languages. You remember how the apostles suddenly spoke with tongues? Well, there are people here who have known this man all his life, and they know that up till one day he did not speak a word of Tamil, a very difficult language. 15 days afterwards, he was able to give a long lecture in pure Tamil and to read it and write it as well as any of the professors. I asked him how he achieved this feat, and he replied, by meditation. Think of that. No book, no grammar, simply meditating on God as these men know how to and asking to be taught Tamil. His face, when at rest, shines with happiness. At the least excuse he laughs and often turns to you and shakes his head in a way Indians have, which means, that's all right, cheero. He promised to spend the afternoon and evening of today in teaching me, and he will then go into seclusion for over a year. He said, if I would come to Tiruvannamalai, he would take me up to see the Maharshi, a Mahatma or very great master, who lives there and who is supposed to be one of the greatest Mahatmas in India.
Part 3. Frank visits the Maharshi. Yesterday I got a day's leave and went on with the Munshi to meet Shastriyar, the master of whom I have been writing. Shastriyar and the Munshi are both chelas, that is, disciples of the Maharshi. We heard Shastriyar lecture for an hour and a half in Tamil to a huge crowd, and he appeared refreshed by his efforts. At 2 p.m., he pointed to the cave where the Maharshi lives, and we set off up the mountain to see him. When we reached the cave, we sat before him at his feet and said nothing. We sat thus a long while, and I felt lifted out of myself. Then Shastriyar told me to look the Maharshi in the eyes and not to turn my gaze. For half an hour I looked him in the eyes, which never changed their expression of deep contemplation. I began to realize somewhat that the body is the temple of the Holy Ghost. I could only feel his body was not the man, it was the instrument of God, merely a sitting motionless corpse from which God was radiating terrifically. My own sensations were indescribable. Shastriyar then said I might speak. I asked for enlightenment, teaching, and he spoke and we listened. In a few sentences of broken English and in Telugu, he conveyed worlds of meaning and taught me direct, which he seldom does, and made me his chela. Not, of course, such a one as the Shastriyar, his own very special chela, but as one of the many that great masters have. The most touching sight was the number of tiny children up to about 7 years of age who climbed the mountain all on their own to come and sit near the Maharshi, even though he may not speak a word or hardly look at them for days together. They do not play, but just sit quietly there in perfect contentment. He is a man beyond description in his expression of dignity, gentleness, self-control and calm strength of conviction. Part 4. Frank's second visit to the Maharshi. I went by motor and climbed up to the cave. He smiled when he saw me, but was not the least surprised. Before he had sat down, he had asked me a question, private to myself, of which he knew, showing that he recognized me. Everyone who comes to him is open as a book, and a single glance suffices to reveal its contents. "You have not yet had any food and are hungry." I admitted that it was so. He immediately called to a chela to bring me food, rice, ghee, fruit, etc., eaten with the fingers, as natives do not use spoons. Though I have practiced eating this way, I lack dexterity, so he gave me a coconut spoon to eat with, smiling and talking between whiles. You can imagine nothing more beautiful than his smile. I had coconut milk to drink, white like cow's milk and delicious, to which he had himself added sugar. When I had finished, I was still hungry, and he knew it and ordered more. He knew everything, and when others pressed me to eat fruit, when I had had enough, he stopped them at once. I had to apologize for my way of drinking. He only said, "Never mind." Natives are particular about this. They never sip nor touch the vessel with their lips, but pour the liquid straight in. Thus many can drink from the same cup without fear of infection. While I was eating, he was relating my past history to the others, and accurately too. Yet he had seen me but once before, and many hundreds in between. He simply turned on clairvoyance, as we would refer to an encyclopedia. I sat for about 3 hours listening to his teaching. He had been shown a book, printed from a manuscript given to me by Mrs. R. W. D. Nankivell, to get his opinion about it. He praised it highly and quoted from it. I heard that on one occasion, when a chela asked him a question, he picked up the book, pointed to a passage in it and said, "There is your answer." Later on, I was thirsty, for it had been a hot ride, but I would not have shown it for worlds. Yet he knew, and told a chela to make me some lemonade. At last I had to go, so bored as we do, and went outside the cave to put on my boots. He came outside too, and said I might come to see him again. Part 5. Fearlessness and a sense of security engendered by contact with the master. It is strange what a change it makes in one, for the moment at any rate, to have been in his presence. I am used to dogs, but still would feel disturbed if one set on me in the ordinary course of events. Yet this happened there, and I only looked at the dog and walked straight on, though it tried to bite me 3 or 4 times. I felt no fear, nor was I in any way upset. I heard startled exclamations, but only realized that there had been any danger when halfway down the mountain. A dog bite is no joke in this country, not only because of the savageness of dogs and the germy state of their teeth, due to the carrion they eat, but also on account of the bad way wounds heal in the heat and to the prevalence of hydrophobia. Frank's version of the Mahatma's teaching. A master is one who has meditated solely on God, has flung his whole personality into the sea of God, and drowned and forgotten it there till he becomes simply the instrument of God, and when his mouth opens, it speaks God's words without the effort or forethought, and when he raises a hand, God flows again through that to work a miracle. Do not think too much of physical phenomena and such things. Their number is legion, utterly indefinite. And once a faith in the physical things is established in the heart of a seeker, such phenomena have done their work. clairvoyance, clairaudience, and such things are not worth having when such far greater illumination and peace are possible without them than with them. The masters take on these powers as a form of self-sacrifice. I know the masters, two of the greatest, and I tell you that the idea that a master is simply one who has attained power over the various occult senses by long practice and prayer or anything else is utterly and absolutely false. No master ever cared a rap for occult powers, for he has no need of them for his daily life. The phenomena we see are curious and surprising, but the most marvelous thing of it all we do not realize, and that is that one, and only one, illimitable force is responsible for all the phenomena we see and the act of our seeing them. Do not fix your attention on all these changing things of life, death, and phenomena. Do not think of even the actual act of seeing them or perceiving them, but only of that which sees all these things, that which is responsible for it all. This will seem nearly impossible at first, but by degrees the result will be felt. It takes years of steady, daily practice, but that is how a master is made. Give yourself a quarter of an hour a day. Keep your eyes open and try to keep the mind unshakenly fixed on that which sees. It is inside yourself. Do not expect to find that is something definite on which the mind can be fixed easily. It will not be so. Though it takes years to find that, the results of this concentration will soon show themselves in 4 or 5 months' time, in all sorts of unconscious clairvoyance, in peace of mind, in power to deal with troubles, in power all around, always unconscious power. I have given you this teaching in the same words as the master give it to their intimate chelas. From now onwards, let your whole thought in meditation be not on the act of seeing, nor on what you see, but immovably on that which sees.